Laozi in his mild way had found this middle position and said yes to being because of that. Buddha makes use of the other capability of human beings as soon as they become free, because if when they become free they can say as a child I, and they can say yes and no. Those are fundamental capabilities of all human creativeness. In Laozi we see the absolute meaning of the human capability of saying yes. His yes is an absolute yes. It is a yes to the world, to life, to the meaning of the world, and it is a free saying of yes. He asserts. He asserts the meaning of being. Buddha negates it. He says no. And this seems the nihilistic answer. Haven't we said that if the meaning of being is absolutely negated, one says there is no meaning to being, that then we have the nihilistic position. Buddha has been always taken, or very often taken, as a nihilist. The strange religion that was founded upon him and with which he has not very much to do is a religion that has been called an atheistic religion, contradiction in itself. He himself was called the greatest pessimist and nihilist in atheistic thinking. Now that should have thrown him out of our course, because we wanted only to consider those thinkers before Plato who had all one thing in common, namely to bring to the world good tidings, happy tidings about men. So Buddha seems to bring not a happy tiding if this position and this opinion about him is right. But it is not. We have to consider Buddha against the background of Indian myth. To come out of Chinese myth, to do this great thing and turn the very central concept of Chinese mythological thinking, namely tail, into its opposite and make it into a free philosophical concept of truth, unattainable truth, so to speak, is already a great thing to do. But it is nothing compared with what Buddha had to do, because Buddha comes out, emerges from the greatest mythical development of all time. At his time, Indian myth had so far developed that Heinrich Zimmer could call it rightly, his characterism of this time, a jungle of mythological systems. And it was and is still a jungle of mythological systems. From the earliest myth, which was already the richest we know, the myth of the gods of India, to the latest, most abstract metaphysical speculations of the Upanishads, and even later, it is all one great unity of mythological systems, one great jungle. The capacity of abstract thinking, speculative thinking, had already at Buddha's time, let alone later, developed to such a degree that the judgment of Nietzsche is always be right to mention both opposite poles of the gift for philosophizing, England and India. If one goes and analyzes metaphysical systems of the Indians, it is absolutely flabbergasting that there has been nothing set new in Europe as far as possible metaphysical speculations and combinations go. All that had developed to the full already at Buddha's time. To contradict that, to cut a path through this jungle, had all one meaning, namely the infinite explanation of the meaning of being that was taken for granted. Universal laws in all possible contexts, infinite worlds, one giving birth to the other, a jungle of meaning. And through this jungle, Buddha had to cut a path showing that all this is meaningless. We have seen in Lao Tse that with this new concept of being, namely being not being taken for granted, but judged by the transcendent person, that with it the time concept changed. We have seen that the human time was brought in by Lao Tse, that he puts human time against cosmic time. He develops a new time concept. So does Buddha. But how to do that in view of the greatest development of space and time speculation that ever has been developed on Earth, namely in Indian philosophy, in Hindu philosophy? We have first to have to take a look at this jungle of mythological systems in order to understand the task of the Buddha. I told you once an anecdote, and I have to repeat it partly in order to go again into this concept of time. One of the lower gods of India has become crazy. Delusion of grandeur has befallen him, the god Indra. And in his heaven, his world, he forces another lower god with a kind of Hephaestus, a kind of artist, an architect, to build ever new chateaus for him in his head. So this lower god gets very busy and exhausted, and he cannot keep up with the delusion of grandeur of Indra anymore. And so he goes complaining to a higher god. This higher god says, I can't do much about that. You must go to Brahma, who is the second highest god at this moment of Indian development. Later Brahma becomes the highest and Vishnu. Here still Vishnu is the highest. So he goes to Brahma, and Brahma says, I can't do much in this matter. We have to take it up with Vishnu. So they take it up with Vishnu. And then Vishnu says, I will handle this. And a young, beautiful boy appears in the chateau of Indra, and Indra looks at him, and he gets suspicious, thinks this look of this boy, that might be a higher god. So he talks with him and asks him questions, and Vishnu, with that boy, answers those questions, one after the other. The wisdom of this boy is a tremendous form of question. And then the boy says to him, Indra, you see those ants crawling there? Yes. How often do you think you have been such an ant? Such many times. I myself, Vishnu, have very often been such an ant. Everything changes. Do you know how long the time of an Indra is? The time of an Indra is 100 million more than, say, an aeon in human life. But this is nothing. For me, this is not even a second. And still I have been this ant. Do you really think that we should build those big buildings? Here is indicated the manifold when William James, protesting against modern science and the superstition of modern science, namely the metaphysical side of modern science, said, let's not call that a universe because we are not sure about it, let's call it a multiverse. A multiverse was already the idea of the Indians. It was a universe and a multiple universe. So all those infinite worlds have different times. They have different spaces too. Infinity as a human concept, infinity of time as well as infinity of space. We have been very proud from Descartes on and from Galilei on how wonderful we have developed the concept of infinity and what we have done with it, for instance, in mathematics. If we look into the free mystical speculations of the Indians as to this one term, infinity, then we see that we are children compared, in imagination at least, compared with them. But in this anecdote is also the death spell of this whole culture already. Because Vishnu has to say, I myself have been this ant many times. So what does that mean? The gods of this infinite cosmos are also beings. They are part of it. They belong to it. They are not transcendent. There is no transcendence in all Indian thinking, before the Buddha and after the Buddha. So the word is used. But in our sense, this highest metaphysical speculation can only add and add in infinity to being. The concepts of being become greater and greater. They are never transcended. There is no abstract concept of time and space. There is only this concept of time and space that comes up by adding. That means there is no concept of eternity in all Indian thinking. Eternity is identified with infinity. Eternity itself is not there. There is not a single concept that transcends being itself. So to speak, if we look at modern positivistic superstition and modern naturalism, this blind belief that came up since Spinoza, that everything is determined and that the all of being, so to speak, is God, and that in the all of being we are only parts and functions, finally, in the 20th century. When we look at this great superstition, which cannot be proved because we don't have a leg to stand on in order to prove such a crazy thing, then it is almost as if the Indians had done that already in a much more beautiful form only. Not so sober not so boring, but the concept is the same. It is the concept of absolute immanence. We again believe in absolute immanence, namely that all is in being, and that we are contained in being, that there is no possible transcendence. We have the same belief, so to speak, cosmic belief, that the Indians have. Only the Indian one is much greater and much more beautiful. It is also much more logical, because if we analyze the terms, the abstract terms of the Indians, we find a much more consistent system of metaphysical thinking than there is in all of Spinoza plus Hegel. It is almost faultless. One term gives the other. That's what Hegel tried to do, namely to show that the whole being can be explained out of concepts, of a system of concepts. That he tried to do, and we are still astonished how great the masterpiece is he did. I mean, as a masterpiece of logical thinking. But compared with Indian mythological systems, it is just a child's play. Those things have been thought through again and again in a tradition of thousands of years. They had been made already at the time of the Buddha so consistent that it was logically almost impossible to raise any objection against it. Not only that the people believed in the myth, but the highest Brahmins, the greatest intellectuals of the country, couldn't get out of this iron system of thinking, which is in itself almost infinite but absolutely consistent. The idea of immanence and infinity is here to such a degree developed that no philosopher who is not able to raise the objection of transcendence could ever say a thing against it. He will always be defeated. And the playing around with those things, we think when we, and admire it very much, when we read in Plato how Socrates handles the sophists, and how the sophists, we enjoyed that always very much, to see how the sophists were able to make a game out of metaphysics, of metaphysical propositions. Well, the Indians played greater games. It is hilariously funny what they can do with metaphysical terms, how they can use the wrong logic that Socrates fought so much against and could use himself so well when he wanted to use it. How they can use it. This tradition goes on later even in Buddhism. After Buddhism has been founded, in the later Buddhism, which has not much to do with the Buddha anymore, where all that creeps in again, we find discussions of Buddhist monks in Tibet, for instance, and still in our time those discussions go on and say, well, this is of course all illusion. The river has never been crossed by the ferry boat. There never was a Buddha. There will never be a Buddha, because both is void. So they make tests with each other to prove to themselves that they are absolute non-believers, that they believe in nothing, and they still are Buddhists in their life and in their behavior. But it cannot concern us what has become of Buddhism, of Buddha in Buddhism, because that would require a whole course. We have to stick to himself and only to what we know about his original teachings. There again we have a hard task to perform, because we have no original texts. The Pali texts, which are the most pure and the oldest, can be relied on to a certain degree. we have only one criteria to go by. That is the life of the Buddha himself, his life, and his fundamental thoughts. It is the same as we will later find it with Socrates. In order to understand where Socrates differs from Plato, we have only two things to go by, but they are absolutely reliable. Namely, what Socrates did and what his fundamental thoughts were. For that we must make one assumption, which we have to agree upon, otherwise we would not be able to proceed. We must make the assumption, the philosophic assumption, that every great philosopher who discovers one or two absolutely new positions would be consistent enough as a thinker not to let creep into his teachings positions that are absolutely contradictory to those fundamental positions he discovered. That means we have to grant him that he is not an imbecile. If we do that, if we assume that neither Socrates nor Buddha could possibly have been imbeciles, then we might be able to discover by inner contradiction of the texts that this could possibly not have been the original teaching of the Buddha. That is our only critical method we have. It is not a scholarly one, because scholars have to prove everything by texts. It is a philosophical method. Philosophers prove by meaninglessness. As soon as a thing becomes meaningless and contradictory, it can't be right. This proof we would have to accept. Then we can proceed by finding what the original thoughts of those thinkers might have been. We saw that the gods of the Indians, those marvelous gods who can perform everything, Brahma dreams the world, or Vishnu, he dreams up one world after the other, the greatest mythological symbol for man already, because man is such a world dreamer who dreams up one world after the other and even enforces this on his fellow human beings because he believes so much in it. Those mighty gods had one fault. They were contained in being and had to change this being. Also Vishnu had to change. He had to become an ant and another Vishnu, and again so, and again. That means everything moved by compulsion. Everything moved by universal laws, unescapable universal laws. There was no getting out of this endless, infinite circle of happenings of being. The Greek gods, as we will see later in Homer, had also a fault. The fault of their greatest god Zeus was that, and the others too, but his too, that he could not die. So Achilles, who could die, and nevertheless, knowing that he has to die, and knowing that later in Hades he will say he wants to be rather the slave of a low man and working the earth on the earth than being Achilles in Hades, nevertheless makes the decision for a very short life with one great deed that people will always remember. He can do that. He can be such a hero. Zeus can never die, so he cannot be such a hero. So in the end, who is Zeus compared with men? the concept of the Greek gods false, because man finally discovers that he is greater than his concepts of the gods. And what is the use of gods if even men are greater than the gods? Our concepts of the gods are limited. The same with the Indian gods. They are contained in being. So what is the use of a god? He is no more than an ant. An ant is also contained in being. There is no transcendence, and therefore there is no value. There can't be any real value as long as gods are parts of being too, as men are, as ants are, as stones are, and everything changes and moves in this great circle, infinite circle. So the gods of the Indians get their neck broken by the Buddha. Buddha is not an atheist, because he puts the gods of India into their place. That does not mean that he would have put the god of Abraham into his place. He would not have, because this is the concept of a transcendent god. Here we have the highest possible concepts of immanent gods, and they are dethroned by the Buddha. In Buddhist legends, legends is told that the gods, that one comes to the Buddha and tells him that he could become a god, that he could become Vishnu if he goes on that way. He says, I become a god, I who is going to become a Buddha and shake all the worlds and the gods by my becoming a Buddha. What does it mean to become a Buddha? Buddha means merely the enlightened one, the accomplished one, the enlightened one, the one who knows, who sees through it, who judges the world. That's one of the greatest Buddhist legends that has the same meaning. That is, when Buddha was sitting under the Bo tree for 49 days, 7 times 7 days, contemplating and meditating in order to find out what the meaning of being is and to give his judgment, he came to the conclusion. He became the Buddha, the enlightened one. He knew, he saw through all of it. He had made up his mind, the mind of man, and was ready and had his judgment in mind. And then he realized that this cannot be taught, that everybody would have to go the same way, the same path himself, and that this cannot be asked, and that therefore it would be useless for him even to try to teach this path.